I think the beauty of the alley is, in my mind, not the alley used for picking up trash. So there is some value there, but more so, really what personally I'm passionate about is what are the human skilled places? And I think the alley is that kind of low-hanging fruit that exists. It's like from sea to shining sea, we have this right of way. Some of them at least are underutilized. So I think that's my passion with alleys, is that so many people have access to it.
Welcome to the Community Center for Marengo Urbanism, a show about bringing people together in every nook and cranny of the city. I'm Kyler. I'll be your host for today. I'm an architect and design communicator based out of Oklahoma City. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest who will be helping us to answer the question, how can we develop a human-scale public realm in cities that have largely developed without such spaces? Thomas Doherty, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you start us out by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I call myself a UX urban designer. I'm an architect, but focus on the urban design element and the design build element. I work with Building Culture, so that's how we got connected. Obviously, they're based in Oklahoma City, doing great work in Edmond and Wheeler. I live in Philadelphia, or outside Philadelphia, and I have projects around the country, but focus on the small scale, the human scale, the infill development.
As you mentioned, I found out about your work by listening to the Building Culture podcast, which if you're listening to this and you haven't heard of that, like, go check it out. You will enjoy it. But, and I also want to say that alleys are important to me. They're very interesting as well, because I sort of began my urbanist deep dive with a study for the OU Institute for Quality Communities back in 2021, where I investigated the potential for transformation and activation along an alleyway in Edmond.
Why that? Because that's obviously like my key topic, or one of my key topics too. So I'd love to, yeah, talk about alleys. So why alleys, and then why that? And then who was pushing that? Was that your thesis? Was that your project, or did the school propose that to you?
What's interesting is, so I got hired in 2021, and that was when I was supposed to do my preceptorship semester with the College of Architecture and go do an internship with an architecture firm. But nobody was hiring in spring of 2021 for obvious reasons. So OU and the Institute for Quality Communities said, well, we have a bunch of projects that we've kind of started. We can just assign people to those. But we took this project, and it was kind of like they'd already done a lot of it and done a study. And they were like, see how far you can push this. And so we said, let's do a pop-up in the alley. Where we actually block it off pedestrian only for an evening. And then we collaborated with the arts festival they have there, Edmond Vibes, which was like pretty new at the time. So they were excited to have something going on back there. And we got chalk for kids to draw on the ground. We actually painted the ground in the alleyway, which ended up not working out as well as we had hoped, because the paint kind of washed off within the week between when we painted it and when the event was. But some of the paint stuck forever and it's still there. So it didn't do either of the things we were trying to do, because we meant for it to be temporary. But yeah, that was how that project came about. It was not our decision, but in doing the study, kind of was like, this is important. And I don't think a lot of people are talking about it.
So what about the characteristics of alleys? And did you have precedent for this kind of pop-up thing? The pop-up thing makes me think of like Yard & Co. And do you know Yard & Co? They've got the twins of their company are based out of Oklahoma City, but they might be worth looking up for you. I think they're based out of like Cincinnati. Maybe that's where their headquarters are. But they've done a few different alley activations with the pop-ups. And one of their arguments is, we need to start getting the conversation out of City Hall. We need to bring together what often seem like disparate groups, you know, if it's like Gown in Town, if it's a city council and local residents, whatever it is, like, let's get them together in whatever the place is. Then from a characteristic point of view, the alley can be transformed in a way that a street typically cannot, I would argue. What defines that street, you know, in Edmond is very likely going to be like including four blocks down. Because it's so wide that like your perception of that space, even if you try to activate like one little area, you're still going to be part of this much bigger space. But then you get in this human scaled alley and you can kind of create your own world. And it sounds like that's what you guys did. That's exciting.
Yeah. We looked at a lot of Better Block precedent from down in Dallas, I think is where they're based.
Okay. I don't know them.
They do a lot of these like pop-up type tactical urbanism is kind of
okay.
My favorite term for it. And then in terms of like alleyway specific precedent, we looked at things like more permanent installations, like I'm sure you know about the City Thread in Chattanooga.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing where it's like, this can really bring a city together. But before we even get into all of that, I do want to ask you, like, when and how did it become clear to you that alleys were something worth talking about?
You know what? It actually goes in part back to Tulsa. I mean, that was like maybe an aha moment. My wife is from the Netherlands. And so going over there as an undergraduate, I studied abroad in Austria. We were there together the same semester, and that was my first introduction to the Netherlands, kind of as an adult to Europe more generally. And so I had memories of places that were a different width. I grew up in construction. I have a general sense of space and width. So coming back, thinking about the spaces that I love there, comparing to the spaces that we have here, my mind went to dimensions, among other things. So I was aware of that disconnect. After I graduated as an undergraduate, I was chasing a lot of those dreams. And one of the aspects that I was focused on was durability and beauty in construction. So I joined the Timber Framers Guild in America, and I worked as a timber framer for a number of years. And that was a really great experience. But it did make me aware that where I'd been focused on buildings, and you know, I'd been in these buildings in the Netherlands and Austria and Germany or whatever, that were made out of brick or stone. They had beautiful timbers. So I was trying to pursue that. I realized that I didn't want to just build, you know, multi-million dollar pool houses, outbuildings, houses for rich people. And I really was aiming for something else. I was realizing, hey, what was I actually perceiving over there? Like, what were the streets doing? What were the spaces doing with the courtyards? And being in Philly was really great because we have this whole network of Philly streets or alleys. You know, Elfrith's alley is called an alley, the oldest residential street in the United States, or it's claimed to be that. And that's actually at that width of alley, right? That's like 18, 20, 22 feet wide. And Philadelphia has this great network of these streets. So I was timber framing. I was near here. I was aware of that. I knew that I wanted to get more into the urban design aspect of it. So I went to Notre Dame. Notre Dame had Douglas Dewani at the time. It had Phil Bess. And I was chasing elements of, let's say, the new urbanism, elements of that traditional human settlement, the understanding of those spaces. And so I was aware of some of these scale things, but I brought it back to Tulsa because I think in 2018, 2017, we did a studio down there. And it was actually that that district just north of Tulsa. It included, blanking on the names now, there's
Greenwood
District. You had the historic, is it Black Wall Street? Is that what is
yes.
there on the east side? So we were doing a studio, and we were working with all of the residents and folks there. And I'm blanking on who. This is a while ago. Jen Griffin, which I don't know if you know. She and her husband John are in Tulsa, and they kind of helped lead that studio. And you know, it's devastating. I didn't know that history until we went. And so that's a little overwhelming. And then to be, you know, actually walking through the blocks, you have all the steps to nowhere. You know, that's like the completely gutted area by urban renewal, obviously the second demolition of that area. And then you go to the west side and you have the reality that you see across the country, which is alleys are no longer being used. And so it's kind of like a little jungle back there. Like, here are the main streets. Okay, and we're talking about incremental development. We're talking about infill. We're talking about the capital required. We're talking about, like, what can the city do? We were in City Hall. We were meeting with the mayor and stuff. You know, how can the city support the residents here? They were planning school there. But I was, like, nagging the back of my mind. I was like, what's this alley doing here? They're like, no matter what, there's, like a fire pit, like there's like broken down cars, like you have a little jungle, like a little, it's like Vietnam in the back, you know, where the lots come together. And I was taking photographs of that. And I think it was like at that moment, I was thinking, this is exactly that same scale of these minor streets in Philadelphia, the most beautiful places we have at this scale. I was also very passionate about the ADUs and what ADUs do from a capital point of view, how they enable homeowners and small builders, developers to start to create that passive income. Even more so, maybe that whole demographic of people that are being squeezed from a housing point of view, it gives them housing. So it was kind of a match made in heaven, realizing, hey, if you're thinking about incremental infill in these neighborhoods in Tulsa, and you have this abandoned alley here, there is the potential, if there was a shared vision, to create this lane back here, which could be an iconic place that once you get inside, kind of like your work in Edmonds, you can create your own world. In some ways, you're outside of the rest of Tulsa. Like, you could make a little island of space that it's not dependent on the rest of the streets or alleys or anything. So you could kind of incrementally improve. You could make this perfect little space and then work on the next one. So that was kind of recognizing ADUs were coming, you know, that we saw that legislation on the West Coast. It was clear that, and now, you know, 7-8 years later, like it is, right? We have an ADU legislation in the town I'm in now. And for most of the urban fabric in the country, you have alleys, or at least a lot of it. And so any place with alleys, there's this resource that's just kind of sitting there, underutilized, and there's the potential to make it into, you know, this human scale place, a scale that we completely lost.
Yeah. I've definitely seen that. And so you've mentioned the alleys in Tulsa versus the alleys in Philly.
Yeah.
I went and I read your book that you wrote, The American Alley, Hidden Resource. And that in that book, you talk about the difference in development between the alleys in Philadelphia and the alleys, the service alleys elsewhere in the country. So tell me a little bit about that.
I'd love to. So, and where I'd love to start with this is actually the land ordinance of the 1780s. Because in a lot of ways, I think people maybe in the new urbanism, whatever, think that, hey, if we could only go back to like pre-World War II, or if we could only go back to like, you know, some like golden age in American urbanism. And I think that there are great human focused examples from that period. I think there are great examples from today of a lot of the T&Ds people are doing. But if, you know, you started when you were talking about human scale, like what is that scale? And how do we figure out what that scale is? I think of Jean Gehl. He's the Danish architect. What does he do? He has a couple books out. He had a movie, I think, that he created at one point with BBC, maybe called Human Scale. But he focuses on elements of the human person, like our, you know, we all walk at about the same speed. We've got the 6-degree cone of vision. You know, what can I see of a person's face at different scales? So like at 30 feet, what am I taking at 20 feet, at 15 feet, like how far away? So just like, what's the human experience? So you go back and like, okay, well, if we're trying to figure out what are the elements of human scale, are there things from the past that inform the future? And I think it would be definitely a mistake to like go simply whole cloth, try to copy something in the past. But there is value, I believe, in going back and studying it and figuring out, well, are there elements that can influence how we build moving forward? And if you go to a place like Philadelphia or Boston, you see a development sensibility or characteristics of space that don't exist elsewhere in the country. And there's a great book called The North Atlantic Cities by Charles Duff. And he's talking about the development of these cities and tying it back to London, Amsterdam. And really there you see not the creation of, but at least like the widespread use of the single family home, which prior to that was kind of an anomaly that you wouldn't see the row house or even the single family home as like a basic building block of urban streets or urban development. One of the things that like, you know, when we're starting, Philadelphia is the first, and I write about this, but it's, you know, it's the first planned city or major planned city in the United States. It really is enlightenment sensibilities or enlightenment thinking. And so you have these, the founding father, I mean, William Penn's on founding father, but later on the founding fathers, they're leaning on ideals to map out a vision of the future. And so you have William Penn mapping out Philadelphia, and he's got two rivers and he's going to develop between two rivers and he has all these big lots. And then you see how it actually gets built. And that's not the reality of how it gets built. And so that the way it gets built is, well, only one of those rivers is big enough for economic use. Everything's going to be built right along that river. We don't have the means. You know, this is a wealthy patron who inherited his money from his dad, who was given it to him by the king. Like, it's enlightenment thinking and we owe so much to them. But at the same time, there's a disconnect from reality. And the reality was, people are a lot poorer. They have to build a lot smaller. We need a bunch of workforce housing that is pedestrian focused and adjacent to the harbor. And so you see Philadelphia develop so much differently. And so they're what they call alleys. And even the term alley at the time has French roots, allée, that it's this narrow street which cuts through a lot of the larger blocks. So you have the larger major street network and then you have this minor street network. So in Philadelphia, those minor streets or alleys were never developed as service alleys. They were just smaller streets fronted by smaller homes, and they would often call them workforce housing homes. And then you get to like, okay, let's get to the 1780s, and you have Thomas Jefferson. Post-war, you're dealing with a huge amount of war debt, and they didn't have a way of taxing the colonies or covering that debt. And the plan that they came up with was, we're going to sell the land west of the Ohio. It was essentially, they had made a treaty with the natives. Hey, we're not going to cross the Ohio. I mean, it was a little more complicated than that, but that was essentially, hey, we're going to stop here. And they said, okay, we got this debt. That was a British treaty. And there were, among other things, citizens in Boston and other places, they were saying, we want to be able to speculate on land. Kind of the same way that Philadelphia was speculation by a British guy. You know, Savannah was speculation. A lot of the money that was coming for these early colonies, those same developers were developing around London. So if you go to like London, you see like Hyde Park, that whole area. It's the same names, last names that are developing these others, whatever. So there's both a need to cover war debt and a desire by wealthy individuals to be able to invest in the West without going out there. So if I'm, landed gentry in Boston, or the colonial version of that, how do I invest dollars? How do I invest capital, speculate on land in the West? And you need a really straightforward way of doing that. And so what Thomas Jefferson proposed, he gets credit for it. I think he was spearheading it. I'm sure it was a group effort, but was basically, we're going to take the Cartesian grid that we map the oceans with, you know. So like, how do you figure your way around an ocean? We put the globe on a grid, and we're going to overlay that on the United States, and everything is going to be surveyed by these dimensions. And they had it baked into this, like kind of like the software of this, like, this is what we think a farm's going to be. This is what we think these different things. So a township is this. Every township has to reserve X amount of land for like a school and different things. So they had these different rules in place. And then following that, you get 1780s. By I think 1820 or something like that, Chicago is laid out. So Chicago is kind of like the standard bearer of this new form. Now, it's just known for that, but similar plots were happening everywhere. Cities are not designed, right? Like William Penn was designing Philadelphia. At this point, you have surveyors going out there and they've got their simple rule book and they're saying, a street is 66 feet wide. This is this. What had been introduced in Savannah, which was not part of Philadelphia, Savannah's maybe 100 years later, was this service alley. And it was kind of a reflection of a couple different things. I think you see them appear as the Mews in England, west of London, so around the Hyde Park development. The guys developing Savannah are also developing outside Hyde Park, and they've developed this thing called a Mews or a lane, depending on where you are. And it's a reflection of development of whole cloth, like greenfield development, that like I can lay this all at the same time. It's wealthy people who have carriages. So it was a way of getting carriage access via the rear, keeping your back of house back there and allowing the, you know, wealthy family to front the main street. So it was new infrastructure, a wealthy class, and spec development that created this muse. And there's great uses for it. Like, I'm not knocking on it, but they brought that to Savannah. And then somewhere in the period of between when Savannah is platted, so the alley is supposedly platted elsewhere in Georgia, but then you see it appear in Chicago. And if you look at some of those early platted plans in Ohio as well, you'll start to see those. And then retroactively, that was brought back. So the town I'm in here in Westchester, I'm sure it originally didn't have alleys, but later on they came and they replatted and they brought the service alley in. So you asked about that history. It was a really long-winded way of talking about it. But I'd like to go back to the land ordinance in part because when you fly across the United States and you see all the circles, and when you're working in Edmond or you're working in Oklahoma City, you're at a scale that is so radically different than human settlements of, you know, up until about 150 years ago, that's where I push back on the new urbanists who might say, like, until like the car wreck thing, so the car, you know, put our scale off, or, you know, post-World War II developers or something like that. And I think the framework was set far before that, and it's really hard to get outside of those lines. And that's my focus on interblock development and alleys, is that you have the Chicago grid out there, every piece of land is taken account of, right? Like you're either private lot, a street or an alley. And only one of those is actually at that scale of that beautiful little street in the Netherlands or the minor street in Philadelphia. It's the alley, the service alley. And there's no way of bringing back new public spaces, right? Like everything's accounted for as a developer or architect. Here's your sandbox. And it's like, these are the lines that were put in place back in the 1780s. Still, when you're working in Oklahoma, you know, there's all this land that used to be the Deep Deuce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's all of these blocks and streets that are mostly empty, but there's nothing magic or necessary about these streets. Like these streets, they were just a reflection of these dimensions that were kind of set going back in the 1780s as a way of like having really clear ownership of land so that somebody on the East Coast can speculate on land out West and do it from the comfort of their armchair and for clarity of like, you know, so the less legal disputes. But we've inherited this huge grid. And now if you put next to like Edmund, like your favorite precedent, you know, from Europe, let's say, it's Dorf, right? Edmund is here. I did this for Austin recently. I often will just show like the ancient city of Rome just for shock value, just because it was the capital, right? And it's like, here is Edmund and this tiny little thing right here, right? That's the ancient city of Rome. Just as when you're looking at densities, when you're looking at scale reference for public spaces, because it's really easy to start thinking at the scale of Edmund's current kind of public space, their streets, but the cost to, you know, do anything to improve that is so dramatic. You really need to get down to that alley scale or something like that to really have an effect.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure. And I thought it was interesting. So I kind of got this sense from reading the book that the streets in Philly, which were originally meant to be residential minor mm-hmm. streets, and then the service alleys in a lot of other cities, kind of by the end of the 19th century had started to converge on what they mm-hmm. were, because mm-hmm. there had been housing that had been developed in these service alleys, and all of these services that were dirty and gross had to be provided to all the residents in Philly. So like, what would it have been like to live in an alley in the late 19th century?
Yeah, right. So I think definitely in the major cities, you know, in the industrializing cities, there was a huge demand for workforce housing, and even where are the poorest going to live, and they're going to live on these alleys. So I think that's one of the things you're referencing there, and why. So we did end up having, let's say, in Chicago, a whole culture of alley development, alley buildings. And I think there were probably a lot of uncomfortable things, a lot of unhealthy things, but also there was a lot of value there too. People did have homes. People were able to create their own sphere. Like even if they were poor, they were able to be proximate to some of the jobs that they were working in Chicago, let's say. So as opposed to, hey, we're going to have our workforce housing. Yeah, we're going to put that, you know, 10 miles that direction. You're going to need a car and everything. At least it was proximate in some ways. DC, historically, were actually at that time, the late 1800s, that early 1900s, that you start seeing them torn down, you know, and codes being put in place to stop their development. In DC, they're building these alley houses before you even build the front houses on the block, which is kind of interesting. There was more demand. And so developers would buy up a whole block, and they would, where the alley did exist, they would then cut out land adjacent to the alley. And essentially, you no longer had your alley, but you had these smaller lots in the center. And that was in part a huge influx of Black Americans coming up from the South. And where are they finding their homes? And in DC, that was the nature of a lot of the alley development. And the ones that remain are really, really beautiful. But unfortunately, so much of that got torn down by national and state and local ordinances. But what was it like? I think in Philly you know, there was concerns about crime, there was concerns about health, there was concerns about fire. Some of it I'm sure is legitimate. I think a lot of it was not in my backyard mentality. And unfortunately, we lost so much of the rich fabric in all of our cities of our Allie Holmes. There's a great book called The Allie Holmes of Baltimore, which documents the gutting of that. And it's amazing when you think about like the thousands and thousands of homes that were starter homes, missing middle homes that were demolished for the sake of, you know, a little bit more light and air of getting poor people further away.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating and frustrating that like the conditions in these alleyways, people saw them, and rather than asking like, how do we improve the conditions? The solution was we need to wipe this away. We need to get rid of this. And I think that we lost a lot in doing it that way, as opposed to how do we meet the needs of these people?
Right. And I'd like to point out that those conditions were pre-electric, pre-gas, pre-plumbing, pre-everything. So we still have, unfortunately, those codes on our books. And definitely that sensibility on our books. We still have in most of our towns, you're not allowed to build a home that fronts onto an alley. You're not allowed to, develop these kinds of spaces still. And yet all that infrastructure fits inside of a cavity wall. So even like the concerns they had back in the day, those are really non-existent anymore.
Yeah. And so you already mentioned ADUs a little bit. What is an ADU and how do we get more of them?
Yeah, well, ADU, accessory dwelling unit. I think the history of that, maybe one story is that there was an initial push for that when the baby boomers' parents were aging and needed a little bit of extra help, proximity and also autonomy. I guess the longer history would be like if you go up to New England or if you go to these other places, there is a long history of building multiple dwellings, let's say, on a lot. You have a lot, maybe it's part of a farm, you've got maybe a main house, maybe you have a smaller house. I mean, even the house I'm in here in Westchester has two stairs. It's a row house, but you had like people living in the back, people living in the front. That was just very typical. And in some sense, that would be your ADU. And that became illegal in different times, different places. But in Philadelphia, they would have tried to make it illegal in part so that you would stop building on the alleys. They would have done that back in like the early 1900s. Probably wouldn't have been to like use-based zoning, Euclidean zoning, that really became kind of blanketly illegal as they said, hey, we're going to categorize single family as a use, right? And so then this lot has one single family dwelling, therefore you can't put the second one on. So back in like the 90s, the baby boomers, there was a little bit of a push, not much, where they said, hey, we want to be able to provide for our aging parents. We want to give them proximity to us, but the autonomy of having their own little unit. And I think in California, there was a few pieces of ADU legislation that was passed, but it kind of fizzled out. And then there were environmental reasons. There are obviously home ownership cost reasons, just cost of living reasons to open that door back up. And so grateful for all the work that people like Cole Peterson, based in Portland, so Oregon, Washington, California, and then other states too. And now it's a common piece of the missing middle puzzle that everybody's attempting to open up.
Yeah. And I think you may be one of the first people I've seen look at how ADUs along an alleyway can actually create a nice minor street out of the alley. And yeah. I thought there were some really interesting studies that you did about the actual form of the ADUs that you need in order to create this minor street and not to just ignore the alley even further.
Yeah.
Tell me about like, what was some of the interesting things you learned when you were doing these studies?
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember in grad school, I graduated maybe in 2018, and then they offered me a year of independent research. Even during my thesis in that 2018 year, I kind of fizzled out because I was realizing I was really passionate about this other thing. So I finished that. I was really focused on, these human scale places like alleys and then how to see the, revitalization of them through the development of ADUs. And I remember a constant question was, how do you promote that kind of group effort that would be required? Like I can see it if it's a single developer buying up a block and developing an alley. But how do you promote that? How do you see that coming to be with ADUs and with each individual homeowner contributing to that minor street? And so far, my projects are largely small scale urban infill, maybe an acre, maybe an acre and a half. And I'm always developing around courtyards and little spaces and passages. Austin is doing amazing work an admin with this. It's been, yeah, such a gift to work with him. But it's still, one of the things I'm passionate about and don't have an answer. So like, how do you promote ADU development and the revitalization of Alley? So in my own hometown, I'm on our Historic Architecture Review Board and Planning Commission. And so my role has been, well, let's start by legalizing them. And that took way too long. But finally, we have a decent, okay, ADU code that is passed. So that's the first step. And I think Cole Peterson did a great job. You asked about like, how do you form these spaces? Cole Peterson did a great job in Portland. He started something called the ADU tours. And essentially he just was starting to make people aware of it. And I think the kind of work that you do is probably the best way to open people's eyes to how do you form this alley into the shared public space by fronting it with your ADU, right? Because you could turn your back on the alley with your ADU. You could make sure that it's just cars and garages, but really to form that space as some kind of public space, that's done physically, right? And so you'd need to have garden walls, trees, buildings, actually giving shape, definition to the space of the alley. So Cole was doing these ADU tours, and it became a big thing there where like every year you'd be like, oh, we have these, 15 new ADUs or whatever. We're gonna go tour them all. And I think some version of that and what you do is probably the best way to open people's eyes and municipalities' eyes to what could be here. And is there some kind of public-private partnership? I would hope that ideally there would be, especially given the smaller infrastructure costs of an alley. Maybe it's the case that the residents are on a block-by-block basis saying, we want this set of codes, or we want to develop in this such and such a way. Can the city come in and repave or add a couple public lights or whatever is needed for safety? But I think, yeah, I think being really intentional about fronting the space that's the alley and actually giving it form, right? Like if here's your alley and on both sides, it's just front-loaded cars and then your buildings are backed up, right? That's not really giving much of a form to your alley. I think you could do parking. I think it just has to be thoughtfully done. Charleston has a great set of alleys in their historic district, which are a beautiful example of less densely developed spaces. Like if you go to Philadelphia, it's very dense. If you go to some of the minor streets along the East Coast, they're beautiful, but they're also more dense than what we're going to see with ADUs. But if you go down to Charleston, it's an interesting example of larger lots, small lanes, and the lanes themselves, which let's say that's equatable with these alleys, are not primarily formed with buildings. They're primarily formed by, let's say, garden wall, arched opening, car park. Now I've got like a little garden shed. Now I've got my ADU. Now I'm moving back down, and so they're still relatively dense, but it's formed by these different pieces, not just row houses or whatever.
Yeah. And I can also imagine you've talked a lot about developing these in more residential type areas that have the service alleys. I can also imagine in a lot of downtowns where you have a service alley, but it's just parking lot next to it. Like you could probably infill that as well and do something similar.
100%. Right. I mean, I like to use this example from Palm Beach, and I'm blanking on the name of the guy. It was developed in the early 1900s by a Spanish architect. Or maybe he was influenced by Spain. Maybe it was like his travels over there. And he was even bringing back like different pieces, like spolia, like different pieces of like fragments of buildings. But he developed this little shopping street inside of a block, right? Similar, like how do you create these human scale spaces? Well, you do it inside of a block. And that's where you find the highest end retail real estate. In Palm Beach, it's in this little lane with little courtyards in the center of a block, and it looks like you could be in Spain. So I think of that with the downtown districts as well, and these parking lots, from Waymo and others can allow our parking lots to be used in a better fashion. I think, very often we talk about missing middle, and Dan Perolik, he was talking about missing middle building types. I think very often it's like, well, it's a missing middle, like economic thing. It's, housing choice. And there are elements of that, but he was talking about building types. And I think about what are our missing public spaces, right? Like go to the little village in the Netherlands and you'll see like, okay, well, we've got a courtyard here. Well, okay, let's say little village in Italy, because I have better words for that. But you have the piazza, like the main piazza, but you also have piazzetta, right? Like the little piazza. You have the street, but you also have, there's a diminutive for like the little version of the streets. You have these different forms of public space. You've got the stairs that are coming down this rich sequence of specific spaces. And then you get to, you know, wherever you're trying to develop in Edmond, and you've got this very wide thing that we're calling a street, but it's defined by curbs, not really defined by buildings, and maybe you have some alleys. That's it. So we have this whole spectrum of missing public spaces, and I think the alley could fit in there as we try to develop those. And if you're developing where those parking lots were in the downtown district, you could all of a sudden start to create that little courtyard, create that little piazza, that little square that we don't have.
You've also talked about how it's technically easiest for like a single developer to take the lot that they have, break it up, put a lane in there. And that's kind of, you know, what happened in cities like Philly and DC historically, which the plans didn't have these alleys. People just, you know, developers created them essentially.
Small scale. Like, yeah, it was maybe like four or five buildings at a time, I think, very often. Yeah.
But yeah, like I think one of my favorite illustrations you did was showing a developer that could develop a perpendicular lane mm-hmm. to an alley and then intersect the alley with a plaza essentially. Mm-hmm. And then that starts to encourage the others along the alley to develop. So I love this kind of like, you know, you've got a problem, you're trying to solve it. Look at the perpendicular solution.
Yeah.
And that kind of can bring a lot of new life to an area. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, it's going to take somebody like you to like figure out how to get that message out.
Yeah, no. And that's the thing is like, I think with a lot of this alleyway stuff, you know, like you've seen historically the people living in the alleyways, the advocates said, we need to stop this. We need to put an end to this. And then as soon as the infrastructure caught up to where you actually can develop along an alley, and, you know, hygienically and comfortably, the same thing happened where, you know, now we have the infrastructure. We don't even need these alleys anymore. So let's stop building them. How do we get people to care about alleys again, or for the first time even? Like it seems right. Like people never have.
Well, and I would say most of the work I've done is infill, and that's the work that I definitely you know, try to do more of, like that acre and a half infill or smaller. But I'm currently, and I've worked on in the past, the larger greenfield developments too. When I've done that, I have also not included alleys, but I've not included alleys because I think the beauty of the alley is, in my mind, not the alley used for picking up trash. So there is some value there, but more so the alley as a human scaled place. You know, back to that land ordinance of the 1780s, and with like a stroke of a pen, all of a sudden we've got streets that are this wide. Sometimes we have alleys that are this wide. We have no plazas. We have no, like, you know, meandering streets. Like, why is like San Francisco like up and down? Well, we're going to overlay this Cartesian grid, and we don't care about topography. We don't care about any of that. So in a lot of ways, maybe like in Philly, like I like want to save the word alley or use a different word, where really what personally I'm passionate about is what are the human scaled places. And I think the alley is that kind of low hanging fruit that exists. It's like from sea to shining sea. We have this right of way. There was a study, like Chicago or something has enough alleys to reach from like Chicago all the way to the Pacific or something like that. Like a lot of alleys, right? That are, some of them at least are underutilized. So I think that's my passion with alleys, is that so many people have access to it. Like if you were to think about, here's a municipality with no alleys. If you were to try to start to legalize, like, hey, I'm going to cut through and create easements for people to build ADUs on like these minor streets, like, just stop. That's way too hard. But we have all this infrastructure right now, and municipalities are deplatting them too, right? The name for the book that I wrote was taken from a pamphlet that an architect put together in St. Louis, and it was called, you might know, Alley something.
A hidden resource, I think.
It could have been Alley Hidden Resource, or missing resource or something like that. And essentially, he was trying to make the case for, let's not deplat these. Right? Like, let's recognize that there's potential here. And that's what I was trying to do. So if it's a greenfield project, in some ways, I would argue for, let's just make some narrow residential streets and make them as beautiful as we can. Like, you know, how do you design for the person? How do you design for the child? How do you design for the elderly? And then do that for our existing cities, which I think that's the real work of you, me, of anybody in our architects, designers. You know, greenfield's a luxury. It's really about how do we develop our existing infrastructure. And I think that's going to be recognizing that so many of the homeowner lots touch on this underutilized public realm that we could transform. So how do we make people love them? I don't know, not in Greenfield, but with the existing infrastructure, I would think it's exactly what you did, which is do these pop-ups. That's why I really liked Yard and Co. for what they were doing. And now you're talking about Better Blocks down in Dallas, is that it was?
Yeah.
Yeah, that tactical urbanism, like what Bitch, you said, I think that like let's get the conversation out of City Hall, you know, with some minimal infrastructure. You could create kind of the stage setup, like here's this human scale place of the alley. And wow, this feels different. My child interacts with this space differently than anywhere else in Edmond. You know, like, hey, I could do this in my own backyard kind of thing.
Yeah. Once people start to see it, they start to understand. And I think
exactly.
We just need more people to see it.
That's right.
So, Thomas Doherty, thank you for joining me. Where might people find out more about your work if they're interested?
I have a website, interblock.org, and I keep, it's kind of like just a loose portfolio. I don't even have any work that I'm working on right now. Buildingculture.com has some of the work I'm working on. So I would go to Austin and all the great stuff that we're working on there. But yeah, Interblock has a few of the topics that are most important to me. Elderly housing, alley work, human scaled stuff.
Sweet. Yep. Thomas, great to have you on the show. And
thanks, Kyler.
Looking forward to seeing future work you do.
Sounds good.
Hey, it's me, Kyler. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to give the show a like, rating, subscription, or whatever kind of nice feedback you can provide on whatever platform you're watching or listening from. If you'd like to join our community to stay up to date or to discuss anything you heard in today's show, consider joining the Aringo Urbanism Discord server. And finally, if you'd like to support the work of Aringo Urbanism directly, you can do so over on Patreon. Until next time.